Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+. Simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
So what the state has to do is to stamp out dissent, and it has to feed us a steady diet of propaganda to overcome the natural evidence that flows our way.
Pope Francis did say there are absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar or even remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage in family.
The entire person, God and man, descended into hell, conquered the devil, destroyed hell's power, and took from the devil all his might.
Washington jet drivers love Issues Etc.
You don't start by suggesting that we euthanize children. That's not where the argument begins. You start that way, and you're going to horrify people. So how is it that at least at this point in the Netherlands, someone is suggesting that they euthanize children? How do you get from wherever you were in the Netherlands, who knows, to, hey, I got a great idea, let's euthanize children? You might say, I can't think of a way to do that. Well, maybe we'll explain how the Netherlands has come to that point here in this hour of Issues Etc. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 28th. Of April. Wesley Smith will join us from the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism to explain that and to talk a little bit about that tricky term, brain dead. Then we'll continue our Christ in the Old Testament series with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Psalm 67 is where we'll be looking for Christ in the Old Testament. You can join us with questions or comments over the next hour. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or you can call our comment line anytime you're listening, anywhere you listen, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about two issues, the euthanization of children in the Netherlands and the term brain dead, Wesley Smith. He's a regular guest, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, author of several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia-Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die, and a recent column for the National Review Online, Netherlands Push to Euthanize Children, and If Brain Death Reversible, It Isn't Dead. Wesley, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, how are you?
I'm doing all right. So explain to us how you get to the point in the Netherlands of suggesting that it's a good idea to euthanize children. Surely the advocates of essentially death on demand don't start there, do they?
Well, you accept the premise that killing is an acceptable end to human suffering, and you start by saying it's only going to be for competent adults who decide they want to die. People then say, oh, okay, that's fine with me. Then you say, well, you know, there's a right to die, and if you're really compassionate, how can you deny this right to children? After all, they can suffer too, and voila, you now have euthanasia up and down the line. Now, this doesn't take a week or 2 weeks, but in the Netherlands, it's taken decades. But the same thing is already happening in Belgium. Belgium legalized euthanasia in 2002, and about 2 years ago, they legalized euthanasia for children. No downward age limit. They leave it to the death doctor to decide whether the child is mature enough, quote unquote, to decide to be killed. Now, realize you're dealing with people who can't even consent to get tattooed, but they can consent to be killed in Belgium, and very soon it appears in the Netherlands, because this is a recommendation by, believe it or not, the Pediatrics Association in that country to do away with the age limit for euthanasia in the Netherlands, which is currently age 12. It started at age 16, and of course, once you unleash the demon, if you will, of euthanasia, it never stops growing. Or as I put it once, it's like the universe. The culture of death never stops expanding.
You say that when it comes to euthanasia, protective guidelines, which are always the big talk at the beginning, and legal boundaries just don't matter in the end. Is that what we're watching here?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it really doesn't matter. Those assurances are put in to give a wary public the false belief that this will be a very minor procedure, just the kind of the exception that is rarely ever done, that we can radically change the ethics of medicine that have been in existence since the Hippocratic Oath 500 years before Christ and not have a problem. Well, that's not what happens. Human beings are a logical species. If you accept the premise that killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering, then what constitutes the kind of suffering to qualify for killing pretty soon becomes in the eye of the beholder, that is, at start, the person who's suffering, and eventually people who are watching the person suffering. So in the Netherlands, you also have something now called termination without request or consent, meaning non-voluntary euthanasia. You have euthanasia of people with Alzheimer's if they ask for it in a written directive before they became incompetent. You have euthanasia in the Netherlands and Belgium for the elderly who are tired of life. In Belgium, they've even had at least three cases that I know of, and that there could be many more, of joint euthanasia killings of elderly couples who were not sick but feared future widowhood. So it wasn't present suffering, it was fear of future grief that qualified for euthanasia. And in one of those cases, the death doctor, the killing doctor, was procured by the couple's son. And when the Daily Mail interviewed the man, he said, well, you know, it would have been impossible for us, my family, to care for my parents, so this was best for everyone. In other words, this couple's son put them out of his misery. So, you know, you don't necessarily get there overnight, although Belgium got there very quickly. But it happens sooner or later because you've accepted the premise. And it's not just over in Europe. Right now in Canada, last year, or in late 2014, the Supreme Court of that country imposed across the nation a right to euthanasia, a right to be made dead. And the parliament is debating how far to take that right, quote unquote. And you've had recommendations from medical associations that religiously opposed doctors be required to either euthanize or refer to a doctor they know will euthanize. In other words, if you have a good Missouri Synod Lutheran Orthodox doctor who thinks killing is a sin, a grievous sin, the medical associations of Canada are basically saying, most of them, well, or the provincial colleges, as they're called, you either participate or you could lose your medical license. This is very, very concerning, and that is the country closest to the United States in terms of culture and proximity.
Where does it stand in the U.S. today?
The United States, we have four states that have legalized assisted suicide by statute or vote. California, unfortunately, my state, which it'll be legal starting in June. Oregon, Washington, and Vermont. And that means that some of your listeners, because I know you have quite a wide audience, may end up with this scenario. You receive a call from Sister Sue, and she says, you know, Grandma, as you know, has cancer. She's expected to die within 6 months, but she doesn't want to wait that long. She's going to die next Tuesday. She has the pills. She wants you to come. She wants you to hold her hand and be with her when she commits suicide. So what are you going to do? If you go and participate in a suicide, you are morally accountable for that, it seems to me. Plus, you're sending a terrible message to Grandma that she's right, her worst fears are correct, that she is going to be a burden or that her family thinks of her as a burden, that she would be allowed to die in agony, that her family is better off if she were gone. But if you don't go, you could face family ostracism. After all, Grandma put you through college. Grandma loved you. How could you desert her at this time of her death? So this is going to change not only the practice of medicine, it's going to really smash and obliterate family values in the sense of putting tremendous conflicts and guilt and terrible dilemmas that shouldn't exist if you had the ethical laws in terms of the practice of medicine.
And this term suffering you said at the beginning, when you accept the premise that death, suicide, or in these cases, really murder, is an acceptable response medically and morally to suffering, what do the advocates of death on demand, what do they include in their definitions?
Well, it depends on whether or not they've got what they want or whether they're trying to sell it. When they sell it, like they're still trying to sell it in the United States, because United States society has not widely swallowed the hemlock, they will say, oh, it's just going to be limited to the terminally ill for whom nothing else can be done to alleviate suffering. Well, the laws that are written, like in Oregon and California, don't require nothing else to be to alleviate suffering. They do require, I believe, 6 months or less to live, which is very hard to determine by doctors. In fact, I have a friend who was given 3 months to live with lung cancer 10 years ago, and he's still going strong. But once the society swallows the hemlock, you end up with the kind of thing you're seeing in Canada, which is they're promoting it in terms of recommendation panels, government panels for the mentally ill. You have the mentally ill euthanized now in the Netherlands. You have psychiatric journals in the Netherlands calling lethal injections for mentally ill patients a liberation, quote-unquote, for the patient and for the doctor, so the doctor puts the patient out of his own or her own misery. You've had a case in Belgium, just as one example, of a woman who had been the victim of sexual predation by her own psychiatrist. He took advantage of that relationship. When she turned, and he was a prominent psychiatrist in Belgium, she turned him over to the authorities, hoping there would be discipline. There was none. So she went to another psychiatrist who euthanized her. You have a case in Belgium of a transgender who had a sex change surgery, was so upset by the result, the answer was euthanasia. So this suffering isn't just about, once you accept the premise, isn't just about physical, like pain, which can be alleviated. It becomes existential. Even in Oregon, you find, if you take a look at the statistics that are published, people are not killing themselves because of pain. They're killing themselves, as they tell their own death doctors, because they're worried about losing dignity. They're worried about losing the ability to engage in enjoyable activities. They're worried about being a burden. Now, these are things that are very important for professionals to help these patients with, but they are remediable, those kinds of fears. Instead, the answer often now in Oregon, in Washington, in Vermont, and soon in California, is a prescription of poison. It's really an appalling form of abandonment.
One other definition question for you here. You have written recently about the term brain death or brain dead, and you're taking, well, you have for a long time, taken exception with this. What's your latest concern, Wesley?
Well, brain dead is a popular term. And it is one means of declaring dead. There's only one death, but there are two means of somebody determining, a doctor determining that a patient has died. One is, let's call it heart death. That's the irreversible cessation of cardiopulmonary function. That's the typical, you know, cardiac arrest. The person's heart stops, they drop dead, and maybe 10 minutes later after some resuscitation and the heart doesn't stop, the patient is declared dead. The other is a complete and irreversible, the key word here is irreversible, cessation of all function of the brain and each of its constituent parts. Total brain failure, you could call it. If that is found to have existed, that's also dead. Even though these people can sometimes be maintained for a short period of time on medical machinery, because the heart doesn't need an impulse from the brain to beat. It has its own nerves. I believe that properly declared, meaning if everything is done right, that brain dead is actually dead, because there's nothing. Now, the question then becomes, was it properly declared? And there is obviously controversy, because people who are declared brain dead are still warm and their heart is still beating, as I mentioned. The reason I wrote about it recently is that a company has said they have the go-ahead to try to use stem cells and other forms of therapies to reverse brain death. And what I wrote was, well, if that situation is reversible, then brain death isn't really dead. I also said I'm not holding my breath. So far, a properly declared brain death, there's never been a restoration of function. And I say that with one big caveat. There's a young teenage girl named Jahi McMath. You may have heard of her. Jahi McMath, back, I believe it was in 2013 or 2014, here in my neck of the woods, I'm in Northern California, as you know, and she was at Oakland Children's Hospital. She had surgery on her throat for sleep apnea. Afterwards, there was a terrible complication. She bled out and was declared brain dead. Her family wouldn't accept that. There was a big lawsuit. Part of the Terry Schiavo's family, their foundation, helped the Jahi McMath mother in this. And eventually, there was a conclusion that Jahi was dead. But the judge in the case kind of worked a settlement out where Jahi's, I'm using the term body in quotes. I don't like to say that because it can be hurtful. Jahi was transferred on a respirator to the coroner. A death certificate was issued, and then she was given to her family, who moved her back to New Jersey. Well, in most brain death cases, almost all, you know, within a very short period of time, the person who is dead, their body starts to deteriorate, no matter the medical interventions to try to keep the body functioning. Usually, that's a very short period of time because brain death people sometimes are organ donors, as you know. Jahi, it's been about 3 years, and she has not deteriorated. In fact, there have been a couple of doctors, one of whom I know, Alan Schumann, who's from UCLA. He doesn't believe in the that brain death is real, but he's not an ideologue. He has examined her and found that while she might have once met the criteria for brain dead, she no longer does, which is huge if true. And so there's now an action, a litigation here in California, to have the death certificate rescinded so that Jahi, now officially dead in California, would no longer be dead. That litigation is pending. I think that this case needs to be investigated absolutely thoroughly by the best doctors in the country, because one, Jahi deserves it; two, the integrity of the system requires it; and three, if something has happened in terms of Jahi's brain, and young people, it's different when they get brain injuries than somebody my age, then science needs to know about it. So I'm hoping that would happen, but you find that the Children's Hospital in Oakland are fighting this case and so forth. It's a big mess. But that's something we should stay tuned for.
Wesley Smith is senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's author of several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die, and a recent column for National Review Online, Netherlands Push to Euthanize Children, and If Brain Death Reversible, It Isn't Dead. You can read them at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Wesley, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Every week he joins us, every Thursday, in fact. We go looking for Christ in the Old Testament. It's not a difficult search. We'll be in Psalm 67 right after this.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is a story about one man's journey from death row executioner to Lutheran pastor. It's titled The Executioner's Redemption, My Story of Violence, Death, and Saving Grace. You can check it out at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Executioner's Redemption is on sale for $12.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, The Executioner's Redemption.